Goshawk inuna berushuten adokusho nigin yaravit inuna ijavit kimanor pat biarer puti garinne kanak nenia
Hello and welcome to Ocean Research Project. I am Matt Rutherford, Executive Director of Ocean Research Project, Captain of the Alt, and I am sitting in a half-abandoned shack in Labrador, Canada. Last time we talked to you guys, I was in the half-sunken fishing boat in Assiut, Greenland, and I had a Labrador crossing, crossing of the Labrador Sea and Davis Straits, that was about to happen. And, you know, it was a concern. The Labrador Sea is can be a nasty body of water. Unfortunately, the cameraman also let, I guess, fear get a hold of them and bailed on us 24 hours before we left. We've been making these videos from this expedition, which are on the website, www.oceanresearchproject.org. And we were trying to make five of them total. We had four of them up that's up on the website right now, showing the different research projects we're doing. And He let fear get a hold of him. You know, you got to learn to control fear, or fear will control you. And I don't know. I guess there was a time when, my friend Simon Edwards says, there was a time when men were truly men. He is referring to the days of Shackleton and Amundsen and Scott to a lesser degree, but Scott had some great men with him. And, you know, I do understand, not to go on a complete tangent about this before I talk about what I've been up to, but I do understand, you know, the days of the Spartans and the days of the samurai and the days of the Vikings were some time ago, you know, especially the Spartans and the Vikings, you know, thousands of years ago, or the Vikings around 800 AD, and the world was a very different place. But at that time, bravery was what it was to be a man. I mean, you were brave. But, you know, Shackleton and Amundsen, man, that wasn't that long ago. That was like 100 years ago. And I don't know, has society changed that much so quickly that bravery is no longer an important value for a man to have? Or I don't know. Anyways, off on a tangent. So we're in Assiut, and it was getting cold. You know, we were getting ice on the boat. Every morning there'd be ice, and if we had any kind of light rains or anything, you know, it would freeze, and you'd have to get in a dinghy, and we couldn't get from our boat. We were tied off to this sunken fishing boat. It was really hard to climb over it, and it was sort of a disaster waiting. It was like a crazy jungle gym where we had to climb down on a barge that was connected to another barge, and they would drift apart with different tides and so on. So rowing the dinghy over, the dinghy would be all covered in ice, and so we had a good weather window, though. You know, I spent some time. We spent 10 days in Assiut getting the boat ready. The boat was as ready as it could be. I had fixed everything we could. We had a new crew member come out, a guy named Mike from the Annapolis, Baltimore area. One of the reasons I chose him, I had about six different people apply or whatever to want to do this position. My friend Andy Shell put it out on his website. He has a podcast that's quite popular. About a half dozen people said, yeah, I'd like to be crew. But I chose this guy particularly because I know where to get spare parts in Annapolis, and he could go and get them for us. And we needed some spares. So he brought a spare parachute sea anchor, which we lost ours in a crazy debacle that happened a few episodes ago, and an engine heater, and some doorknobs and some other things. I haven't really talked much about heating, and it is getting cooler, so I think this would be a good time to do it. It's really important to understand how you're going to heat your boat. And one of the things you hear about especially liveaboards that live aboard in cold areas, and they talk about, oh, it's so hard to live on your boat in the winter, and, you know, it's the boat's cold. And most of the fires that occur on boats happen because of space heaters. Your average space heater draws about 1,500 watts, maybe roughly 15 amps, I guess you could say. And now your sailboat has about 30 amps of, you know, it's rated. You got a 30 amp shore power cord. If you have a bigger boat, you might have a 50 amp. But a lot of sailboats have a 30 amp shore power cord, which means the wiring inside of your boat has a 30 amp max. And what people will do is they'll end up plugging multiple space heaters, electric heaters, into their boat, and this ends up frying the wiring. It melts the wiring. And then the wires connect, it makes a spark, it makes a fire, and the boat burns down. And sometimes it burns the boats down that are around the boat. You know, two or three boats will burn down. So it's a, you know, shore, running your heat from shore power is, can be a dangerous thing. And in the past, when I lived on a boat in the winter, I used a heavy extension cord. I always was afraid to run the space heater through my ship's wiring. And at the end of the winter, almost every time, the connection would be melted on this heavy-duty 15-amp extension cord. So just imagine what it does to your wiring. So you got a few other options. You got a diesel heaters, you got propane heaters, you got kerosene heaters. I've had very little experience with kerosene. You don't see them very often. Propane heaters, like a Dickerson makes one, for instance, they kind of mount it on your wall. The nice thing about propane heaters is they're very easy to start, and they're very clean, and the chimney is relatively small diameter, maybe, I don't know, 2-inch or 3-inch chimney, so you don't got to make too big of a hole in your deck. But the problem is you can burn through some real serious propane using one of those heaters. You end up going through a lot of propane. It can be a relatively expensive way to heat your boat, and you might need your propane for cooking or other things. So a diesel heater is really the best way to go. Now, there's a couple different types of diesel heaters. You got like a reflex diesel heater, Webesto. It's the same basic philosophy. You have a diesel heater that was originally designed for semi-trucks and for heating the cabin of a semi-truck. So, you know, the idea is the guy in a semi-truck, it's cold wherever he's at, he can pull over, he can leave the engine running and idle, and he can heat his cab at a very efficient fuel usage. And they're incredibly good heaters. And I have S-bars on the boat, and but they take too much power. You can't really use them when on anchor. So although an S-bar or a Webesto is probably one of the best ways to heat your boat in the winter, that is only if you are tied off to a dock and you have shore power. Now, they don't use a ton of shore power. You're not going to melt your wiring. It's nothing crazy like that. Your electric bill is only going to be maybe $20, $30 a month, in the United States at least. It's not, you know, a big draw, but it's enough that you'll have a hard time keeping up with it on anchor. Your other option is like a Dickerson that makes a diesel heater, but they're incredibly dirty and sooty, and there's you know, they're just really hard to keep clean. The best option really is a reflex heater. The reflex takes no power, where the Dickerson, you have to have a little pump. And the little pump, it takes some power, and really the power isn't the biggest issue with one of those Dickerson wall-mounted diesel heaters. The problem is you got to listen to the damn thing. The pump is sitting there going tick, 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 tick all the time. And it's enough to either drive you crazy or you just block the noise out. But do you really want to be sitting there listening to some pump tick away all the time? So a reflex, and I believe it's spelled R-E-F-L-E-K-S. It's Danish, I believe. It takes no power. It's gravity feed. It doesn't carb up unless it's got an issue. But typically speaking, they don't carb up. And they're just really reliable heaters. So if you're on anchor, then it's a great way to heat your boat. If you're in a marina, it's a great way to heat your boat. They put out a ton of heat. There's also a wood-burning stove. Now, I have a wood-burning stove. I have a reflex heater, and I have S-bar heaters, and I have an engine heater because I'm just spend a lot of time in cold places, so I've damn near every different type of heat you can have. Wood-burning stove is awesome. It's great, but you need to cut wood. Where are you going to store the wood? They're not cheap. You need to have a big chimney. So there's a variety of issues with wood-burning stoves. I like them because I just like burning wood. But I like looking at the fire. I like to have the fire. There's something pleasant about having a wood-burning stove on a sailboat. But they're not the most practical way to heat your boat. And then when you go to bed at night, you're not going to keep feeding it wood while you're sleeping. So the fire's going to go out and the boat's going to get cold. Where a reflex heater, it will stay warm all night. The last way is an engine heater. And the reason I went down this tangent, or what got me to this tangent, is that the engine heater on my boat broke. This is also known as a hydronic heater or a bus heater. Basically, this is a heater for your car that I got at Summit Racing for like $160. Summit Racing is just a thing, you know, it's a company that sells parts for cars. And you hook it up, and it takes the coolant from your engine, which is hot, and runs through this little radiator with a fan on it. And basically, it gives you the ability to heat your boat anytime the engine is on. And it's not just about heating your boat. That's only really part of it. It's also about keeping your boat dry. So it really works in both regards. It heats your boat, and it keeps the boat dry. And yeah, it's awesome. So mine broke, and I had Mike bring out another one from Annapolis. And he had it shipped to his house, and he brought it out with him. And we installed it, and we got the boat, you know, all ready to cross the Labrador Sea. And as I said, this I was getting crazy about the weather. There's a couple of great places you can get weather forecasts. If you're on land and you have proper internet, one of them is called Passage Weather. Passage Weather gives really good sort of large scale weather forecasts. Typically, you're not going to get localized weather for the most part. But if you want to sail, you know, say Annapolis to Bermuda, or I don't know, California to Catalina Island, I guess, you know, it's a relatively short run. But if you're doing any kind of longer passages, and if you have any kind of satellite communication information where you have somebody back on land who's keeping an eye on the weather for you and communicating with you, this is a good site for them to look at. So check it out if you haven't heard of it, called Passage Weather, and it's free, and it has good forecasts for whenever you want to do a passage. The other one I've talked about quite a bit in the past is Predict Wind. The beauty, of course, of the Predict Wind offshore program is that you can get weather forecasts on your boat at sea using a Iridium Go. And they're very good forecasts, typically speaking. Now, I'm not going to say you get very good forecasts up in the high Arctic. We had some issues with that. But it's not the fault of Predict Wind. It's just there's no good forecasts up there to begin with. So I was checking the weather, and I was checking the weather. And I actually also paid Commander Weather, which is another option. Commander Weather is a service that it's a paid service, and it's expensive. But you pay these guys, and they're sort of like a team of meteorologists, and they will give you forecasts for like $80 a pop. As you can imagine doing $80 a pop on a 10-day crossing. You just spent $800 on weather forecasts. And they're good forecasts, though. And it, basically, if you pay them once at the beginning of your trip for $80, they track your position as you're doing whatever ocean passage you're doing. Every day, you send them a little update with your latitude and longitude. And so they track you. And if any storms are coming your way or any bad weather is in the in the future, they will send you an email and give you a heads up and say, hey, look, you know, I see there might be a storm coming in 2-3 days. Why don't you slow down or turn north or south or whatever to try to avoid that storm? So really, with Commander Weather, I wouldn't suggest paying them for an entire crossing every day. You'll end up going broke. So I had this. I had a Commander Weather. I was looking at Passage Weather every day. I was looking at Predict Wind. I was trying to find this weather window, trying to get my window to get across. And finally, we saw it on the 18th. So now it was time to leave. But anyways, I'll come back and tell you guys about the crossing of the Labrador Sea after the commercial break.
Hi, I'm Sarah O'Kelly, founder of Skipper's Review. I started Skipper's Review because I wanted somewhere online for my local boating community to make connections and recommendations. So now it's up and running. I've been getting out of the office to enjoy the Florida sunshine and to meet some of my members. Each week, you can hear me swapping salty tales with sailors, surfers, swimmers, divers, boat owners, and builders, anyone with a story to tell about their life and their relationship with the sea. So join me, Sarah O'Kelly, with Skipper's Review on Boat Radio.
Hello, and welcome back to Ocean Research Project. I am Matt Rutherford, Executive Director of Ocean Research Project, Captain of the Alt, and I am sitting in some kind of shack thing. It's about twice the size of a garage. It's completely full of fishing equipment, heaps and piles of lines, nets, a bunch of old fisherman anchors. It has quite a smell. It's a really musty, funky smell in here. But, yeah, I'm sitting in this place. It's raining outside where the boat is tied off to a pier, to a seawall. And we are in southern Labrador, Canada, heading from Greenland on back to the United States. So we are in Assiut, Greenland, looking for this weather forecast, waiting for a chance to get out to sea and make it to Canada. We have about 1,000 miles we had to sail. And my boat does about 100 miles a day. It's a slow boat. Most of the reason for that at this point is because I got a cage that I had to build for the ice, and it's slowing me down big time. Now, I asked the guys at the boatyard in Sisimiut, Greenland, where we kept the boat last winter, to build like a professional cage around the prop to protect it from the ice. And they said, yeah, sure, we'll do it. And, of course, it was broken English. I don't speak Greenlandic, obviously, and they don't speak much English. And I got back to the boat this year, and the cage wasn't built, and they were really busy. And so it was just like, well, I'll just build it myself. And so it just took some metal out of the dump and bent it, some pipes, and welded it to the boat. And, you know, it worked well. I mean, we were in some incredibly heavy ice. And we had a lot of ice going underneath the boat, because that's just what happens, and bouncing down the hull. Never once, of course, did it hit the propeller. That's the problem is your propeller is spinning fast, and if a chunk of ice hits your fast-moving propeller, it could lose a blade. And if your propeller loses a blade, then you're in a world of trouble. So anyways, one of the reasons I went to Assiut was to cut this cage off the bottom of my boat, but the his boatyard, this guy who just bought it recently, some Middle Eastern guy, actually, who's married to a Greenlandic woman, and he hiked the prices through the roof. And he wanted $2,500 to haul the boat out for 3 days, which is insane. In Annapolis, at the most expensive boatyard, I can get hauled out for $600. In Sisimiut, Greenland, where I kept the boat for the winter, I can get hauled out for $440. This guy wanted $2,500, which is, you know, I paid like $3,000 to get hauled out and keep the boat in Sisimiut, Greenland for the entire winter. So anyways, we just didn't have the money. And so the whole point was to haul it out, cut the cage off. Now I'm going to do it when I get back to Annapolis. I'll haul out at Jabin's for $600, cut the cage off, and be done with it. But it's slowing us down quite a bit. So we're doing 100 miles a day. Now, with weather forecasting, you can get a decent weather forecast out, you know, 3 days, 4 days. You can get a really reliable forecast for 2 days. You can get a fairly reliable forecast for about 4 days. But about 6 days out, you know, it's sort of a toss-up. You know, it's like, well, looking that far out, it might happen, it might not. It's really hard to predict what exactly the wind's going to, you know, what direction it's going to be how hard it's going to blow, you know, that far ahead of time. But we had a good window to leave, at least. So we left out the harbor of Assiut, and we ran right into a pod of whales. Now, we had seen whales before, but these whales were right off the ship, really, really close. One of the interesting and sort of strange things about fishing boats in Greenland, a lot of the older wooden fishing boats, which I would say make up at least, I don't know, 60, 70%, maybe two-thirds of the fishing boats in Greenland are old wooden fishing boats. They have harpoons mounted on the front of the boat for, you know, shooting whales with harpoons, big harpoon guns like you would, you know, you would have seen 50, 60 years ago or longer. And, you know, my thought is that I think these harpoons are really like hood ornaments. You know, I mean, nobody's, as far as I know, nobody's really going out there and shooting whales with these things. And if they were going out and shooting whales, there was no way that a whole pod of giant whales could be hanging out right outside of a harbor that has a bunch of these boats with harpoon guns mounted on them. So I think they just keep them mounted on there as some kind of like hood ornament. Like, I don't know what else reason there would be there. So this, you know, they were right by us and it was really beautiful. And it was really calm. We had really light winds in the forecast. And, of course, the engine was running, so the engine heater was running, so it was relatively warm. Outside, it was like maybe, I don't know, 30 degrees or something. It was a little below freezing. The first couple days, we had some little snow showers and sleet. It was too cold for it to rain, so we just got snow. You know, it's whatever. You know, you're in a pilot house. You're protected. The engine's running. You're warm and dry. So, you know, let it snow. It's actually a bit of a novelty to have a bit of snow on when you're underway. And again, it was flat calm. One of the cool things about it being cold, and it was at night. I bet you it was getting down to around 20 degrees. I mean, it was getting quite a bit below freezing. The water wasn't freezing, of course, because, you know, it has to be really cold for a really long time, really cold for a while at least, before you're going to get ice, you know, 100 miles offshore, if even at all. You know, there's enough wave action to keep ice from forming out there. But one of the cool things is that when it gets really cold like that, it makes a clear night sky, and we had some incredible displays of northern lights, just really phenomenal. You know, it was 8 or 10 ribbons of light just dancing above the boat, greens and yellows swirling and dancing, and, you know, it just looked really trippy, for lack of better diction. For lack of a better way of describing it, it just looked really trippy. And so it was just beautiful. We'd be out there, and, you know, with three people, we do 3 hours on, 6 hours off. And when you have light winds, it's really relaxing, and you're out there, you know, you're on night watch by yourself, and you're watching the northern lights dance above the boat, beautiful starry nights. It was just, it was really lovely. We only saw a couple of icebergs coming down in the 1,000-mile trip. Most of the ice at that point is north of Aasiaat, and the way that the currents work in Greenland is you have a current that goes north along the coast. So any ice that comes out of Disko, and quite a bit of ice comes out of Disko Bay, it all goes north. It doesn't go south, and we were just south of Disko Bay. So we saw one berg at night when I was on my watch. I tracked it on the radar. It was, you know, a mile off. I barely see it in the moonlight. And then we saw another berg in the daytime. And I wanted Mike, you know, Mike just came on the boat, and I wanted Mike to see at least one iceberg. It's almost a shame to go all the way to Greenland and not see an iceberg out in the ocean. So we motored right up to it, and we put the boat in neutral. You know, we were close, but it was the safe distance off. And, you know, Mike had snapped some pictures of it. But we also took this as an opportunity to have our a last glass of whiskey with glacial ice. Now, icebergs come from glaciers, so they're made of glacial ice. And glacial ice, icebergs, have air trapped in them that has been trapped in the ice for 1,000 years. In some cases, a lot longer than 1,000 years. I mean, it's hard to say, but at the very least, you got 1,000-year-old air trapped in that ice. And so you take a chunk out of the water. There was all sorts of little chunks of ice floating around this berg, because this berg It was near its final days, you know. I mean, it had broken apart quite a bit. There was a kind of a field of little ice around it. So I grabbed some ice up out of the water, smashed it up with a hammer, and threw it in our glasses. And when you pour the whiskey on it, and we didn't drink much, you know, just a couple fingers. But when you pour the whiskey on it, it snaps and it crackles and it releases that thousand-year-old air into your whiskey. And it's just a real sort of novelty, you know, to be able to do it. So we celebrated what I assumed to be the last Arctic iceberg that we would see. And I was right. I mean, we didn't see another iceberg after that. We're getting near the line for the Arctic Circle. So I figured we wouldn't see much after that. And there's a car passing by outside right now. I don't think anybody's going to come in here, but anywho, I don't know what they're up to. This building is sort of an abandoned shack. It looks like the car's turning around. Well, the door was open on the shack, so I came in here. And like I said, it's just full of old discarded fishing gear. It has a sign out front that says Max Marine. So it must have been a marine store at some point down the line. But, so yeah, it was nice. We saw the last iceberg and we carried on from there. And for basically the first 5 days, we had no wind. So, you know, it's sort of ups and downs to that. Well, we can't motor forever, obviously. So I have about a 700-mile range with my fuel. So we needed some wind. But after about 5 days, the wind picked up, and it picked up out of the north, about 15 to 20 knots on the quarter, which is, I mean, sort of the epitome of fair winds and following seas. We got into the Labrador through the Davis Straits and into the Labrador Sea. Labrador Sea is always a sort of a murky, dismal place to sail. I've sailed across it 3 times now, and it's always been gray. This is actually the least gray, because in the past it's always been heavy, heavy fog. But, you know, it was cloudy skies and rain. Pretty much for the last 5 days, it was just constant overcast and light rain. But who cares, right? I mean, you got winds, you got 15 to 20 knots behind you, pushing you along. You're moving along at a decent speed. Sometimes they were lighter, sometimes they're only 10 knots. You're in your pilot house, so you're not wet. You know, you're dry inside your pilot house. And so it was really a really peaceful crossing. It was really nice. You know, the Labrador Sea can be a whole lot of things. You know, and it's 1,000 miles that you have to sail. And, you know, when you start, you're still up in the Arctic. There are icebergs. There are really wicked storms. I mean, when we were right before we left, there was a storm in the Labrador where the entire Labrador Sea was blowing, at the very least, gale strength. And a lot of it was, the center of the storm, it was blowing like 60, 65 knots. That's like a tropical storm. That's a proper, serious storm. You know, so anyways, it wasn't bad. It was nice. Poseidon was looking out for us, because we had a really good, peaceful crossing with light winds and motoring and winds behind us. So we had very, very little headwinds. And then we showed up in Cartwright Labrador. Of course, I've never been to Cartwright Labrador before, but Labrador is the stretch of coast on the Canadian side north of Newfoundland. And Cartwright is one of the more southern towns. It's about maybe 200 miles north of Newfoundland along the coast. And it's a town of about 500 people. But it's a beautiful town. So we pull into Cartwright, and it was like a total change of everything. Pull into Cartwright, all the clouds go away, the sun comes out, it's like 65, 70 degrees, beautiful weather, there's trees. And I know that might not sound like something, but I hadn't seen a tree since May. You know, and one of the nice things about Greenland is its desolate beauty. But there are no trees in Greenland, at least not in the parts we were at. Maybe in the southern tip, I've never been down there, but I didn't see a tree. It was just rocks and rocks with moss. That's all you got in Greenland. And there is a beauty to that kind of raw, desolate nature. But at the same time, it's really, really nice to see a tree, you know, this living, big living organism. So there was pines mixed with birch, In forests growing on the sides of the sort of mountains and hills, more big hills than they were mountains. And the birch, all the leaves were turning yellow, and it just really made for a beautiful, beautiful scenery. And Cartwright, nice thing, Cartwright's a great town, has a free seawall we tied off to, had a grocery store, a gas, has a fuel truck that will come to your boat and lower down a hose so you can fill up with diesel, has a bar, and I was just kind of laughing. The lady who was the waitress at the bar, you know, we were in there every night, not because we were drinking every night, but that's where the free Wi-Fi is. Anyway, I know we had a beer or something, but the lady had the slowest, she talked so slow and had such a strong accent. It was just incredible. Nice lady, though, but just had the most incredible accent that I probably ever heard for an English-speaking person. You know, it was such a great place, and they had free showers, they had free laundry, you know, like I said, free Wi-Fi, a free seawall to tie off to. The people were super nice. Everybody waves. Everybody smiles. Everybody asks you if they can help you with something. We had to check in there. This was our first port of call, so we had to check in with, like, the police. And, of course, the first thing to ask you is, do you have any guns? And I say, yeah, you know, I had a shotgun and a rifle for polar bear protection. But, you know, they were nice, and they drove us to the police station, and they went through the forms. They were, like, the nicest police officers I think I've ever met in my life. I mean, everybody was, like, the most incredible. It's a, you know, it's a small town, 500-600 people, and they don't have paved roads. All of the roads are dirt roads, which kind of adds a bit of an ambiance. Kind of nice, actually, in some ways. You know, and this guy named Garfield, they're sort of a mix. They're not really Inuit there. North of there, they're Inuit. But they're not really, Inuit's another word for Eskimo, but there's definitely a blend. You can definitely see that they're a blend of sort of Inuit and white, I guess. But this guy named Garfield, just driving along in a truck, stopped and said, hey, you know, you want to see the sights, jump in the truck and I'll show you, I'll drive you around. So he drove us down these crazy, bumpy dirt trails up the sides of these hills to where there's these overlooks, there's little gazebos with overlooks, and you can look over the water and the islands. Maybe they're, I don't know, 800 feet up or something. Look over the town and the beautiful forests with the yellow birch leaves mixing with the pines, and a beautiful sunny day. And I mean, it was just awesome. He had a little dog with him, and apparently there's like 25 black bears that like live in that area. But they, you know, nobody seems to care about them. They say you can pretty much walk up to one and cuddle it if you want. We're used to polar bears up north. We're like, oh shit, you know, a bear. But I guess, you know, black bears just aren't that dangerous. But we didn't see any. But anyways, it was just such a nice time, and everybody was so nice and friendly. And you know, we got a box of cod tongue. Nicole doesn't like the idea of eating tongues, and I don't even think fish have tongues. I don't really know, to be honest. But anyways, we got 1 pound of cod tongue. I figured, well, hell, when am I going to be able to buy cod tongue again? So we're going to fry that up tomorrow. But anyways, got to go to a commercial break. I'll be back soon.
Earliest prehistory reveals mankind's innate connection to the sea. From boats of woven reed in Egypt, to Homer's black ships of the Trojan War, down to the naval battles of Greece, Rome, and every civilization since. I'm Brandon Huebner, and I'll present the history, archaeology, and literature that connect us with our past on the sea, all that on the Maritime History Program. Join me as we voyage down through the ages and witness the development of sailing, trade, and much more. The Maritime History Program, with me, Brandon Huebner, every Wednesday here on Boat Radio.
Hello and welcome back to Ocean Research Project. I am Matt Rutherford, and I'm sitting in some shack thing full of fishing equipment. It's a sort of guerrilla podcasting or guerrilla radio show at this point. My vessel, the Alt, is tied off to the end of the of this little, they call it a tickle. I'm trying to figure out what exactly a tickle is, But when we tie it off here, there's some guy and his kid, and he's there's another town called Black Tickle, which isn't far from here. And he says, yeah, this is the Tickle, which I guess means the dock, the wharf. I guess they call it Tickles. I don't know. But anyways, maybe I'm tied off to the Tickle, I guess. And it's raining outside, and, you know, I got Nicole and Mike are on board the boat, and I don't want to do my radio show, you know, they're talking and doing other things, and I needed somewhere quiet to go, and it's raining outside. So I walked up to this shack that said Marine Max, a real old old sign on it. Looks like it was written 50, 60 years ago, and the door was open. So I walked in, and I am sitting on a big orange fender. I got a lantern on the floor, and it's really dimly lit right now, almost spooky in here, to be honest. There's all sorts of old fisherman anchors and fishing buoys, and this looks like a communal place. I mean, all this stuff isn't owned by one fishing boat. It's kind of like a place where the local fishermen must dump their gear, I guess, because there's just piles and piles of coiled fishing line, 5 and 6 feet tall. There's only really one little spot in here that's not complete. This place is almost completely full of junk, like fishing stuff. And I'm sitting in the one little area that's maybe 5 feet by 5 feet, where you can actually see the floor. The rest of it is just stuck full of discarded fishing equipment. But anyways, so we were in Cartwright. Nice little town. You know, it really makes you want to cruise Labrador more, and I would suggest it. You know, Newfoundland is a really nice place to cruise for a season, I have heard. I've been sailed past it a few times. I've never stopped because I've always been going somewhere north up into the Arctic, but I'm sure Newfoundland has got to be a great cruising ground, and everybody I know who's sailed there just raves about it. But why stop at Newfoundland? You know, you can shoot up in the southern Labrador and up the Labrador coast, and if you get up far enough, the top half of the Labrador coast is like a national park. You're not going to find any food or fuel or Wi-Fi or any of that sort of stuff. You need to bring your supplies with you. But from what I understand, it's just absolutely beautiful. A lot of good hiking, you know, big forests, and it's just got to be awesome. But I can hear the water underneath me right now. There's some wind out there. Anyways, I'll get to that in a minute. So we left out of Cartwright, and we were there for only a couple of days, and I needed to get some fuel because we burned most of the fuel motoring down from Assiut, and get some groceries and, you know, do the basic, do some Wi-Fi and write a blog and all that sort of stuff. I could have stayed in Cartwright, though, for a lot longer. Everybody was just so nice. But anyways, we left. We had a weather window. We got to go. We're not here to hang out. This isn't a sightseeing trip. This is a research expedition. The majority of our research is over, and now it's time to get back to Annapolis, Maryland, and finish this expedition. We did collect some microplastics samples when we were crossing to Labrador, and we are still doing ocean acidification research, collecting ocean acidification data as we go south. But the majority of our research that was Arctic, all the Arctic-related research is over. And, you know, it's been a long expedition. It's been 4 months. 4 months nonstop with basically no breaks. Just one project to the next, one location to the next, one problem after the next. We're tired. And the boat's tired, and, you know, the boat's doing fine. I mean, I guess the boat isn't really tired. It's probably just us. But we need to get back. So we left out of Labrador. There was one iceberg, according to the Canadian ice charts. They were sort of on a corner, and there was a nor'easter coming. So I ended up deciding, let's leave at 8 o'clock at night, motor through the night. There was like a shortcut we could take where we stayed close to land, but we had to weave in and out and through all these little islands and rocks. And it was the middle of the night, so you can't see any of the islands or rocks. But I have really good charts on a Raymarine, and the charts down here, unlike Greenland, where you got a chart overlay, of course, on a chart plotter, And the chart overlay in Greenland, it can be up to 2 miles off. And that's a lot off. 2 miles is a lot off. So it can show you 2 miles different than your real position up there. But here, it's very accurate. You're accurate within 100 feet or something because you're no longer crazy far north. So we were weaving our way through, and, you know, there was enough light I could basically make out the islands in the darkness. And it was, again, it was flat, calm conditions, but I knew this nor'easter was coming. So we worked our way out, and we got sort of around the corner. It was about 50 miles or so from Cartwright before we could actually turn south again. And right as we turn south, the sun starts to come up, and the day becomes light, and the nor'easter starts. You know, you go down to first, you're at a first reef point, then you're at a second reef point, then you're at your third reef point, then you take down your main completely, and you're just under a jib alone. But we were close to shore, and the wind, you know, we were getting protection from the shore. We didn't have a lot of fetch, and so the waves weren't that big, and it didn't blow that hard for maybe more than half a day. By the evening, the wind had pretty much abated. But that was the plan. I needed to make it around that corner before the nor'easter started so I could have these northerly winds pushing me south as opposed to trying to deal with these northerly winds when we're weaving through these islands and it's blowing hard and there's rocks and stuff. You know, you want to do that when it's flat calm. So we continued south. It's only another 100, 120, 150, yeah, maybe 150 miles south until we got to Bell Strait. Bell Strait is the body of water, that is just north of Newfoundland, and it's what separates the island of Newfoundland from the coast of Labrador. And it's not huge. I don't know, maybe it's 20, 30, well, it gets narrower at places. 30 miles, maybe, something like that. It's not terribly wide. And there's a good deal of traffic in there to Newfoundland Labrador standards. I think I saw a freighter today. That was the great deal of traffic, but there can be, it was called the Detroit Express, but anyways, there can be traffic in there that you got to keep an eye out for, and there's also pretty strong currents. So, we get in there and you know, we have the current with us, and then we have the current against us, and then the winds kind of clock around, and we make it about 80% of the way through the straits, which is about 80 miles long. And then all of a sudden we have 15 to 20 knot headwinds, and we have the current against us. The wind and the current both switched around right on the nose. I look over, and I'm hugging the coast of, you know, of Labrador. We're on the north side of the strait, and hugging it relatively. I mean, we're a few miles off. And I can see off in the distance there's some houses, buildings or something, I don't know. And I look on my chart, and I don't see the name of any town on it. It doesn't really say anything in particular. So I say, what the hell, let's turn off, and we'll go over there and check it out. I knew these winds were only going to last 6 or 7 hours, and then they were going to turn back out of the north. And, of course, the tide changes every 6 hours, so then the tide will switch around too. So eventually we'll get the tide back, and we'll get current back, and we'll have it all in our favor. So we start going over, and, you know, we're heading closer and seeing more buildings, and we see this dock. It looks really dilapidated and funky, and looking at it through the binoculars and trying to figure out, okay, is this dock, you know, is it close to land? Does it look like a jetty or a wharf? Like, what is this thing? And so we get closer and we get closer, and I see, okay, well, this thing looks like a place where fishing boats used to land. And that's exactly what it is. I mean, the fishing boats don't use this place anymore. I mean, I see a lot of discarded fishing gear around me right now. God knows how many years this gear has been in here. I mean, this stuff looks pretty old. It could have been in here for 20 years. I mean, who knows? The concrete wall itself is just completely falling apart. Big chunks of concrete are missing out of the seawall. You got all sorts of big, funky screws and things that are potentially poking out that could scratch your boat. I put a lot of fenders out, but, you know, it's just a really funky, it's just, you know, it's dilapidated. It's fallen into disc, just like this shack I'm sitting in right now. It's just, it, you know, nobody really uses it. It's just sort of fallen into disrepair. So we tie off, and there's a guy with his son there, grabs a line, and, It's really hard to understand, even though they're speaking English, they have such a strong accent. It's not just Canadian accent. I mean, Canadian accent's pretty easy to understand. It's something completely different. I mean, Labrador, when you got a couple of Labradorians or whatever speaking to each other, like in Cartwright when we were at the bar, we'd hear them talk to each other, and you couldn't really understand anything they were saying. And even when they're talking to you, I mean, some of them, you'd have to ask them to repeat themselves. You feel bad, you don't want to be like, I'm sorry, what'd you say? I'm sorry, what did you say? And sometimes you just say, yeah, you don't even know what they said. You say, yep, yeah, okay. You just agree with whatever they're saying because you don't even trying to be polite. But anyways, he sort of, asked the guy, I don't know where, I said, what's the name of this town? It's West St. Monroe. I said, okay. Is there any place in town that has Wi-Fi? And he said, yeah, there's an Ocean View Hotel, up the road. They don't really give very good directions in Labrador. It's the same way in Cartwright. They just sort of point. So, yeah, we walked in that direction. They did the same thing at Cartwright. They're like, if you ask where something is, they just sort of, they don't really say, walk up here and turn left and go to this road and turn right. They just point in a general direction and say, hey, it's over there. And I guess because it's small towns, it's not that people are just used to that sort of thing. I guess it's small enough that they don't have to worry about what the name of the... I don't even think the streets in Labrador had a name, to be honest. So we walk down the street a bit further, and this, I see a car going on the road. So I sort of jump out in front of this car, and I ask the guy, hey, where's this Ocean View Hotel? And it's an old guy in a car, and he says, well, why don't you jump in the car, and I'll take you. So he drove us down to the hotel, and luckily for us, the hotel is closing tomorrow for the season. So we got there on the last day, and there was nobody in the hotel. And the lady who owns the place just happened to be showing up at the time and opening the building for us. She called a cook, and this lady showed up 20 minutes later, the cook. And she cooked us the best fish and chips I've ever had. I mean, it was fresh caught cod. It was thinly breaded. It wasn't too oily. The French fries were made from potatoes right in front of us, basically. It was just the freshest, nicest meal of fish and chips I think you could possibly have. Everybody was super-duper friendly and nice. Everybody in Labrador just seems so nice. And so we were able to get some Wi-Fi done. I had to write a blog and work on some stuff, get some, it's nice to have Wi-Fi. And we had pie, too. I had a slice of pie that I couldn't tell you the name of it. It was some kind of berry that grows locally. I couldn't tell you what it was called if I tried. But anyways, I mean, it's so nice. I mean, here we are going down Bell Strait, bucking into headwinds and into currents, and you see these, this is only a town of 80 people. I mean, it's not a very big town. You see a few houses scattered on the hill, so you go over and check it out, and you find this dilapidated dock you can tie off to, and then you find that there's a little hotel in town that's closing tomorrow because it's late in the season, and somebody gives you a ride there, and then we eat, and they gave us a ride back, too. The cook, the lady who was the cook, she ended up, after we got done eating dessert and doing a little bit of Wi-Fi, she drove us back to the wharf, or the tickle, I guess, whatever they call it. And here we are now. And now I'm in this shack, and there's people keep coming down here, driving their car down to the wharf, and I'm guessing they're checking us out. Word gets around so quick in these towns. Probably there was a big poker game tonight. I overheard the lady talking. Probably half the town gets together to play it. Word probably got around that we were here, and so there's a car sitting outside of this place right now. But from here, we got to head down to Sydney. It's about, 500 miles, I guess, to get to Sydney, Nova Scotia from here. We're going to try to make the push nonstop. And looks like Hurricane Matthew is going to be paying us a visit. Right now, Hurricane Matthew is looking like it's going to hit Jamaica real soon and then possibly go up towards the east coast of the United States and then potentially slam right into Nova Scotia, where we are going to be. And so we're going to go to Sydney. We will arrive probably on the 6th. The hurricane will probably arrive on the 8th or 9th. And, and we'll ride the hurricane out down there. So, Sydney's a good enough place to ride it out, hopefully. And it's on the north side of Nova Scotia, and this thing's supposed to hit the south side. Not that Nova Scotia is terribly wide or tall or whatever, but I imagine we're going to have some real, real strong winds and surge. But we'll deal with that. So, you know, it's the way it is, man. We got to go south. I'm obviously not going to go out in the ocean if a hurricane's coming. I'm going to tie off to the safest place I can. And there's seawalls I can tie off to down there. So I'll tie off to a seawall and, you know, hopefully everything will be all right. So, yeah, I'll talk to you guys here again, I guess, after this we get down to Sydney and after this hurricane passes. And hopefully I don't have any stories that are too exciting to tell you. You know, in the meantime, you guys have yourself a good week. And you can see the videos from this expedition at www.oceanresearchproject.org. And you can always make a donation via PayPal on the website. We can't survive without donations. So, yeah, have a nice week, and we'll be leaving here in a couple of hours. We're going to leave at about midnight. Right now it's about 10 o'clock at night. So we'll be leaving at midnight when the tide and current and the wind switches around. Head out. We're going to be right behind another gale. We're going to be following on the footsteps of a gale, basically. Much stronger wind is going to be ahead of us, but as it heads south, there's going to be 15 to 20 knot winds right behind it. So I'm sort of chasing a gale down the St. Lawrence, the Gulf of St. Lawrence to Sydney, and then hiding from a hurricane. So anyways, talk to you guys later.
Kuin nakasi, kuin nakurau, kuin naikasi, kuin asua.